next session number 11092, Reel 2.
Colonel Wood, Reel 2. You've made clear the eagerness of you and your men to get into action. Did that reflect how long you'd been training?
Yes, I think it's difficult now to appreciate quite how we felt at that time, but I took over my platoon in March 1942, and we trained ad nauseam until the night 5th, 6th of June 44. A lot of initiative was used as to our training, all kinds of things, from street fighting in Southampton and up in Battersea, to field firing, to turning night into day for 3 weeks, which was quite the most appalling period as far as my stomach was concerned that I can ever remember. Being dropped off at night in trucks and made to find our way across country to a rendezvous. A lot of detailed work in the vicinity of bridges, obviously related to what we were going to do in the future. And really, it was a major problem, I guess, for my company commander to keep us all keen and interested throughout that long period. He succeeded. His success, I think, can be measured by the fact that our company was chosen from all the companies within the what was then the 6th Air Landing Brigade, for this particular coup de main operation. The General Sir Richard Nelson Gale, usually known as Windy, and the Brigadier were out and about choosing who they wanted for this job and chose our company, which says much for my company commander and the way in which he trained us. But yes, we were raring to go. We wanted to get into action, if you like, before the war left us behind. Most people had more than a bellyful of action before very long. But at that time, and I mentioned earlier our disappointment over not going to Sicily, as a young, enthusiastic 19, 20-year-old platoon commander, all I wanted to do really was to get into the war.
Can we jump ahead now in your career, because you were in Greece in the post-war period. Did you have anything to do with the civil war that was raging in Greece in the late 40s?
Not really. We went there as a battalion in 1949 to Salonika, where we were in a camp outside the town. We knew that up in the mountains there were so-called guerrillas, but we weren't fighting anybody, and we were at peace as far as our being there was concerned.
But you were involved, I think, in something called Operation Musketeer. What was that?
That was a good deal later on, you see. In 1956, when I had been a G3 operations in Headquarters 1 British Corps in Bielefeld in Germany, when the Corps Commander, General Stockwell, was sent for to form a new headquarters called Headquarters 2 British Corps, who were destined, as it turned out, to go on the Suez, as it's normally called, Operation Musketeer. And General Stockwell moved from Germany to London, where he was joined by a number of his senior officers, Chief of Staff, Engineer, Signal Officers and the like, and one or two pencil sharpeners like me, who after a spell in London went via Cyprus to Port Said and the classic French-British Suez operation in 1956.
What did you actually see of the operation?
Well, I went with the headquarters, and as you well appreciate, a Corps headquarters is in normal circumstances rather remote from the day-to-day action. We went, in fact, across in a fast mine layer called HMS Manxman, and then put our headquarters into the Suez Canal Company buildings. But because the area was so limited, a small anecdote will explain, I think, what I'm going to mean. As a G3 on duty at night in the headquarters, the Corps headquarters, the telephone rang, and I answered it, and it was the Corps commander, no less, saying, "I've heard some firing, David. What's going on?" So I said, "I don't know, sir, but I'll check for you." I rang up divisional headquarters, who were not more than half a mile down the road, and I said, "The corps commander wants to know what's going on." And the divisional headquarters asked brigade headquarters, because they knew nothing about it. And brigade headquarters came back with the answer that two British patrols had opened fire on each other in the town of Portside. I then faithfully reported that to what, after all, was a corps commander wearing Lieutenant General's badges of rank, a fairly uncommon situation. So in that sense, I was involved in the day-to-day action. But of course my work was really to do with operation orders and routine reports and the like, until I suppose the time came for us to leave the area as a result of the agreement that we should, was it about the 22nd of November, move out of Portside and hand it over to the United Nations forces, who arrived to take over from us. Again, as a slightly off the record anecdote, the Indian battalion came into our corps headquarters, or rather its commanding officer did, to take over at a place called El Cap, which was one of the railway stations down the canal itself. And he was supposed to take over at 6:30 the following morning, and we were very anxious that he should take over tonight so that we could get our troops back and evacuate the place. And he, in very friendly but in my view rather typically Indian style, said that officially he couldn't take over till 6 o'clock the next morning, but unofficially he would take over at 6 o'clock tonight, which as far as we were concerned was an ideal solution to our problem. It was by no means all fun and games. You will remember, I think we lost about 22 men, and they had been buried and had to be dug up and their bodies had to be removed. And there was a classic case of the lieutenant who, through his own stupidity, I'm afraid, was captured by the Egyptians and kept sealed up until his body was finally discovered. He'd been murdered. And this was sort of headline news on at least 2 weeks' worth of the front page of the Sunday Express at home at the time. So I don't wish to make out that we had a jolly time there. We didn't. But it was an extraordinary operation in that we were all in such a confined space, and you've got these very large headquarters, cheek by jowl, with the men who were actually trying to control what was going on in the streets. And indeed the corps commander himself got involved in an episode down by the railway station where he virtually took control and ordered people and told them what to do, which for a corps commander is quite unique, I would think.
What other particular problems did you have as G3 during that operation?
Well, I think it was largely trying to help those who had the problems, if you see what I mean, my seniors who had problems over our involvement with or without the French, and what was coming through in the way of signals from London about what the future was to be and what was what we were going to do. So in a minor way I worked very hard, but I personally was just carrying out my job as a G3 ops.
Was there any problem with coordinating with the French?
Certainly not at the level that I was involved in, and not at that particular time. You see, I think the fuss, though I was a very junior officer, so I think the fuss really was about what was happening or had happened prior to the operation. Once the operation started, we worked very closely, I would have said, together, and without any problems that I was aware of at all.
What were your feelings when the operation was unexpectedly finished?
I was very disappointed indeed. I always felt that we could have gone much further down the canal, much more quickly, if we'd used the initiative which we'd had at the beginning, especially with airborne forces. But in many people's minds, of course, Arnhem still loomed very large, and they thought that if we captured the various crossings across the canal at intervals between Port Said and Port Suez, the troops who carried out the operations might be isolated, and so probably they made exactly the right decisions in that they said we were going to approach most cautiously from Port Said southwards, and it was this that took the time. And of course it was whilst we'd got just a very short way, I think it was about as far as El Cap, that the whole operation was called off.
How do you spell Cap?
C-A-P.
When did you go to Cyprus for the Eoka emergency?
I joined my battalion there after the Suez came in 1957. And the battalion was stationed in a very substandard makeshift camp, a place called Polymedia. And Polymedia is just outside Limassol, and it's probably best known for the fact that the original camp there, the huts of which still existed, were designed by and the plans for them drawn up by one Captain Kitchener, the Royal Engineers. But our camp was just a makeshift affair of tents and a few huts. And from there, we operated as a battalion. I actually commanded support company, which in normal days would be the company in which you found the mortars, anti-tank guns, and the like. But our job at that time was very similar to that of an ordinary rifle company, except that we had four ferret armoured cars in my company who went out under their platoon commander into the mountains in an attempt to control Grivas and what he was up to. We had quiet periods and very active periods, and when things were hot, they were very hot. For example, you could be sent, as I was with my company, down into the town of Limassol as town company commander. And whilst you were there, you would have a platoon which was at instant readiness to move, and two others who were perhaps at 15 minutes notice to move. And sadly, there were far too many instances of people being murdered in the streets, British officers and soldiers, and one would rush to the scene in an attempt to catch somebody who had done it, but nobody knew who had perpetrated the crime. Nobody actually had seen anything, and it was very difficult to catch anybody. We worked in close cooperation with the Cypriot police, and there was a special group of Turkish, I suppose they were armed police, I'm not sure, with whom we cooperated. Our whole efforts were concentrated on trying to catch Grievous, and it has been rumoured since, in fact I think he's written a book about it, that he not only was in the town of Limassol when we were looking for him, but on one occasion our men, not I hope in D company, in support company, got as far as getting into the kitchen, in which he was hiding in a hole under the sink, and he was about to burst out and make a bid for freedom when, because he was sure he was going to be discovered, when someone shouted outside that the tea had arrived, and in the best British Army style, or so he says, the soldiers gave up the search to go and have their tea. We got involved in a lot of civil riots and problems of that kind, stone throwing and funerals, and flags being illegally flown. Enosis was the key word, wasn't it, that the Greeks used. And in searches, endless searches, I recall particularly going to a village quite near our camp where the Eoka had supposedly hidden weapons in and around the village. And this was a most laborious task of searching everywhere, both in the houses and in the stone walls and the like, which surrounded the village, and we had some success. We found weapons of one kind or another, but I'm afraid the bit I remember best was that we behaved in typically British style. After we'd searched the village, my next job was to go to the commissioner, that is the British commissioner in Limassol, with aerial photographs on which I had marked where we'd been searching, so that he could subsequently pay a compensation to the owners of the land for the damage we'd done in carrying out the searches.
Was there much damage?
Yes. In the sense that if you are going to try and find a pistol or a grenade which is hidden in a what you and I would call a dry stone wall, you've got to knock a lot of stones off if you're going to find the weapons that were hidden there. Of course, we were working on intelligence that said that this particular village was one in which it was suspected weapons were hidden.
Were there any, what you might call, punitive raids conducted on villages to punish them for supporting the guerrillas?
I think I wouldn't use the word punitive. I would certainly use the word follow-up. I'm not sure that everybody was as careful with hindsight as they might have been once they got into the village. But as an example of what could happen, an ambulance was on its way to the hospital at Episcopi, and they were fired on from an ambush near a village, and a quick follow-up action which took place found what was suspected to be the site from which the ambush had been laid. And they went into the nearby village. When I say they, I mean the troops did, and they found a couple of men still in bed with their boots on and shaking with fear, and these men were arrested, I guess. I wasn't involved in this operation myself, I guess not too gently, and a further search no doubt was carried out to see if some more evidence could be discovered to prove that they had been involved, as everybody suspected they had. But again, of course, we had these camps into which suspects were put, and in which they were held, if you like, in internment without probably being charged. And I remember going home on a course in the United Kingdom and having a very difficult conversation with a wing commander who happened to be a Canadian about the way in which we treated the suspects in Cyprus. And when I told him the story I've just told you, and then told him that the suspects were kept in camps where their families were allowed to visit them with food, and where, as far as I was able to tell, they were not badly looked after and fairly well treated, and the accommodation was quite reasonable, I think he took a slightly different view of the original one that he had about how beastly we, the British, were being to the Cypriots. It was a very difficult situation because in Limassol itself there was a large Turkish minority, and of course the Turks were, they felt anyway, in fear of their lives from the Greeks, and perhaps facts subsequently have proved that there was something in that. But our job was to keep the two from killing each other, quite apart from Aoka's efforts to hamper our operations, and when they felt like it, to kill us.
So how many Aoka men did your unit catch, do you think?
I can't answer that. There was a place on the outskirts of the town called Milpol where suspects were held and interrogated, but most of that was done by the special branch, and we would take suspects in after the sort of incident that I've just told you about, and I'm sure that some of them were subsequently proved to be terrorists and convicted, but I couldn't tell you how many. I could just say in passing that, of course, we had these photographs on the wall, a la Northern Ireland and all the problems they're experiencing there now. And these photographs had a cross placed on them when the suspect had been either captured, killed, because that is, you know, what we were in the business of doing, was to kill people. I mean, I don't mean, I don't wish you to mean think that we executed anybody or killed them out of hand, but when we got involved in firefights with AOKA, the object of the exercise was to kill the other side or be killed yourself.
Did your unit suffer many casualties in Cyprus?
I'd have to just check, you know, what did happen in that respect. I don't remember immediately that we had it. I mean, I remember going to the odd military funeral, but I'd have to just check the figures before I could give you a proper answer to that.
How much fear was there on the part of troops going about their business in Cyprus, say off duty and so on? Did they feel secure off duty?
Again, it varied very much between whether we were in a hot time or a cold time. I mean, when things were, in inverted commas, normal, we would go down to the tavernas and on the beach and enjoy ourselves, apart from the fact that we probably had to take some weapons with us just in case, in much the same way as we did when my battalion was there in 1950 and 51, when we were the only battalion in the island. We moved there from Salonika in 1950. But when things had hotted up, we were all confined to camp, and you never went anywhere without your personal weapons, and we provided endless guards on everything from a cement factory to a communications centre. And the men on these guards, working very long hours of duty and having to be very alert, were not frightened. I think they were rather contemptuous of AOKA, as a matter of fact, perhaps sometimes a little unwisely. It was my job to remind them quite how vicious AOKA would be, although of course there were instances from time to time of murders. I'm thinking particularly too now of one was of a Scottish regiment were playing football, and AOKA planted a bomb in the fountain where they went to have a drink during the interval in the game, killed some of them. And the other was, I think, the Norfolk Regiment, who were up in the Troodos Mountains pursuing AOKA, and the forest was set on fire. I honestly don't know whether deliberately or not. And a number of men, perhaps as many as 14, lost their lives as a result of not being able to get away from the fire itself.
Whilst you were in Cyprus, what was your opinion about the attitude of the Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot populations, for that matter, towards the British presence there? Did they seem to welcome it or not?
I think it varied between, first of all, whether you were a Greek or a Turk. If you were a Turk, you made us very welcome and looked to us for your protection, because they were in the minority, and it was one of our roles, for example, in Limassol, to keep the Turks and the Greeks away from each other. The Greek population as a whole, with the exception of a small minority, I would have said, were friendly disposed towards us. But they had their problem in that they were terrified by AOKA, with its cryogenesis. AOKA caused far more casualties amongst the Greek population than we did, and so I think it was they who were calling the tune, and the local population were dancing to it. But I had never felt myself that they, if one can use that term, the local population, wanted us to go, nor were they very enthusiastic about Enosis.
Did you ever come across people who said personally to you, why don't you go home?
No, personally not. There was a lot of propaganda. There was a paper called the Times of Cyprus, I think, which was quite well known at the time, which published under its editor a lot of remarks of the kind that you've just made, but not to me personally, no. We were there with, 17 major units in the island, but we didn't succeed in our major objective of capturing Grivas, and in the end, the whole thing had to be resolved on the basis of talks between Archbishop Makarios and the government, and it was agreed that we should hand over Cyprus to the Cypriots and be allowed to keep sovereign bases in places like Decalia and Episcopi, an arrangement which I suppose suited us and was also to the liking of the by then Greek Cypriot government. The problems with the Turks were of course to come much later and to rend the island apart in a way which to those of us who had been there more than once was probably the most tragic thing that ever happened.
In the early 60s I think you had some connection with the suppression of the rebellion in Brunei. Can you tell me what happened?
Yes, then? The battalion, that would be the first Green Jackets by now, were posted to Penang in Malaysia in 1962, where we enjoyed being the only battalion on a delightful island. And it was in December of that year when, in fact, I was at home in England on a course, on a Sunday afternoon after lunch, that the duty officer was rung up from headquarters, Far East Land Forces, and asked if the battalion, which was at no notice to move at all, could move that night down to Singapore. The duty officer reassured the headquarters that they could make such a move and went to see the colonel, Todd Sweeney, who was just finishing his lunch, and told him that we were required to move. Indeed, the battalion did move that night by rail to Kuala Lumpur without its second-in-command, that was me, without its adjutant and several other key officers, leaving behind in Penang some 200 families. When they reached Kuala Lumpur, there was a classic staff college story where a young officer from GHQ met the colonel and said, "The plans have all been changed. You're not going to stay in Singapore. I want you to come down with me in a light aircraft, handing over to your senior major, because tonight you are going to embark in HMS Tiger and make haste to Miri in Sarawak, which is where the battalion landed. I'm not quite sure how many mornings later, at dawn. They expected some opposition, but there wasn't any. And they then, having established themselves ashore, sent companies inland by whatever means was available, mostly up rivers in boats of one sort or another, to relieve local white people who had been ensnared by the rebellion and who badly needed rescuing. The whole thing lasted only a few days, and we then, as a battalion, having, as it were, cleared up the local situation, we ourselves moved up to what I think was called North Borneo, but later Sabah, where we had companies at such places as Jesselton, and remained there for 4 months, after which the battalion was moved back to